Hello and welcome to the very special 30th Tortoise Shack Live. We're here with an audience of our amazing patrons who we love and with the hosts of the Tortoise Shack. So this week I am joined by Tonia Martin from the Echo Chamber. We have James Leonard from the Two Norries and Dr. Vicky Conway from Policeton, Ireland. So welcome, and if you want to be here next week, really easy, just go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and you can be here having the crack and talking about all the great news stories of the week. So we have an absolutely jam-packed show this week, so we are going to kick off. And one of the first things that we are going to talk about this week is I'm delighted to be joined by some volunteers from Abolish Direct Provision Ireland. And we are going to be having a chat to them about the white paper that came out this week, which was stating that the government planned to abolish direct provision by 2024. So I'm going to ask our volunteer from ADP to come in and tell us a little bit about what that means for people in direct provision. So good morning. How are you?
Thank you very much, Linda and team, for organizing this wonderful gathering. So my name is Owen, and I would just like to share a bit about the white paper and our campaign position. I know it's been a hot topic, both by the left and the right, so they should be entertaining. So our campaign is basically a grassroots campaign of asylum seekers and volunteers. And when we look at this white paper, it's basically a disappointment. We have consulted all the centers in Ireland, and asylum seekers are basically upset about what is given in the white paper. And basically, they're saying that it in three parts, or maybe four, what the white paper does not achieve for asylum seekers. So first, looking at the current situation, the white paper don't address the issue with the backlog. Like, you have some asylum seekers in direct provision for 17 years. You have a woman in direct provision right now and is 14 years in the system and mentally damaged. You know, an amnesty would have been sufficient for those persons in the white paper. But the white paper does not address these issues. Also, you have a lot of children that are born in this system. You know, the only thing that they know is a bedroom with a kitchen and everything else. You know, the white paper doesn't address these issues. What is going to happen to these children in the next 4 years? You know, they don't know any other country but Ireland. Also, with regards to the profiteering aspect, which is the second disappointment, is that the profiteering in this system still continues. The contractors that created this system will receive €1 billion in the next 4 years. That is more than what they have received in the last 20 years. And that is why our campaigners are very upset as well, because the profiteering aspect creates this vacuum of brutality in direct provision. You have some centers where women are not even given nappies, you know, basic period products. You have women have to ask men in these centers that are staff for these products. So the white paper, again, is a disappointment for families in direct provision. And then thirdly, which is a very important point, is that there was no consultation with asylum seekers by majority in this white paper. I'll give you an example. When the Katrin Day report made an announcement, it stated that asylum seekers were asking for help. Now, we consulted asylum seekers, and majority of them don't know what is help. So definitely, you have a situation where people are putting things in a report without consulting asylum seekers. Now you have the white paper. They're saying asylum seekers are getting their own houses, you know, which is a joke. Asylum seekers do not own these houses. You know, the keys are not given to asylum seekers. The keys are given to the managers, which can inspect the center, the rooms at any time. We receive numerous complaints from asylum seekers daily. You have men going into women's room to search, to inspect, unannounced. You know, that is not ownership. So by saying asylum seekers are getting their own keys is misguided propaganda, which is creating this racism in Ireland. And the white paper, again, is promoting that. And finally, frontline workers. There are over 800 frontline workers are essential workers in direct provision. Nothing is mentioned what is going to happen to them in the next 4 years. you know, some essential workers are going to work by bicycle 2 hours. 2 hours, waking up 4 a.m. in the morning, and yet they're getting deportation letters. The white paper doesn't address these issues. And that is why we as a campaign cannot celebrate it. Okay? We accept that the Green Party entered into coalition to get this done, but yet the manner in which the white paper was created is not sufficient and not achievable. So as someone told us when we were meeting, the government accepted responsibility that direct provision is wrong, but yet have not accepted, accepted that it's wrong, but not accepted responsibility. So as a campaign, again, we cannot support the white paper, and we're open to dialogue to have a system that address everyone's need and is cost effective to the state. So thank you.
That's all right, Owen, and thanks very much for coming. We're going to bring in your colleague, who's another volunteer with Abolish Direct Provision, who's Nita. Nita is going to read out a letter from asylum seekers who are in direct provision, who are working on the front line. So, Nita, thanks for joining us, and go ahead and read out what you have there for us.
Hi, thank you, Linda, for this opportunity. Dear Honourable Members of Dáil Éireann, after many months of collaboration, the essential working asylum seeker community have decided to humbly approach the Dáil for assistance. We are requesting favourable consideration in granting us leave to remain in Ireland. In recognition of the contributions made to the Irish economy and society during this pandemic. As known to you, we are refugees who have had to leave our countries of origin because of a well-founded fear of persecution because of reasons including our race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion. Ireland is signatory to the 1951 United Nations Convention relating to the status of refugees, which obliges the Irish government to provide protection to people fleeing their countries for the reasons above. This is not an exciting journey or comfortable option in any sense. We live without our families. We left them for their safety and benefit. Asylum seekers generally live in direct provision accommodation centers around the country, meaning they are provided with accommodation and food, but with very little privacy or independence. We are determined to integrate into society as Irish taxpayers and build a future for ourselves and our families. We are out there doing the best we can to contribute to Ireland. However, this has not been made easy for us. We have had to find our way to work, come rain, snow, or sunshine. We have been denied the basic right to drive, so we find ourselves walking or cycling for hours to get to our place of work. Some of the places we live are so remote that bus services are either not available or very limited. We have not complained about this. We want to contribute, and we are, despite the obstacles and challenges faced. There are between 500 and 800 essential working asylum seekers currently risking their lives every day during this pandemic. Asylum seekers with a wide range of qualifications are reporting for duty, from healthcare workers, carers, cleaners, cooks, security guards, food factory production, general operatives, construction, and metal industry. Asylum seekers are making a difference to the everyday lives of Irish people. We are proudly contributing and paying taxes. We are a vital part of the efforts to make Ireland a better place and healthier community. We are essential workers during this pandemic. Numerous countries, including Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, and Canada, have recognized the contribution made by asylum seekers working on the front line during the COVID-19 pandemic. By granting them full citizenship rights and permission to remain in recognition of their selfless efforts to care for the vulnerable, we, Ireland's essential working asylum seekers, are seeking the same recognition from the Irish government. We are humans crying out for recognition of our efforts and dedication. Treat us like you would want to be treated. Show us you care and understand our needs. Grant us and others like us the privilege to voice our concerns and to find a solution to achieve our stated goals. Leave to remain for all frontline essential workers. Freedom for our children, Ireland's future adults. To be treated as citizens of this country with dignity, grace, and respect. Humbly yours, essential workers and asylum seekers.
That's very powerful, Anita. And I just want to point out that Owen and Anita are putting themselves at great risk by coming on and talking about this. If you criticise the system of direct provision, you risk being moved. You risk being moved to the other side of the country. I've seen it myself here in Kildare. People who've been critical of the management in their direct provision centre have been moved to Galway. Their kids rooted out of school and sent straight away. So I appreciate the fact that you've come on and are talking to us today. Tell us a little bit about how the mood is in direct provision at the moment, post the paper. I can sense that you're really feeling that it's not what it's being labelled as. And it sounds like it is a relabeling of the system that's there and that the same people are going to profiteer from it.
Yeah, Linda, the mood, you know, we have a conference every year for all the direct provision centres. And we usually keep in contact via the representatives in WhatsApp group. And it was an outpouring of disappointment. And not only in direct provision, but also among our supporters and allies, because it's not what they voted for. And if there was no COVID-19 restrictions, there would have been mass protests, which we're preparing for as soon as restrictions is ended.
I think, you know, I don't know if anybody else wants to come in on this as well, but, you know, there is a hands up, as you said, but there's no accountability of, you know, we've caused this. What do you think they need to do next?
They need to have a collaboration, a systematic collaboration with all groups so that we can speak with one voice. Because as you would see with the white paper being published, and you have some media agencies saying that asylum seekers are getting their own houses. And then you have NGOs retweeting that and saying, oh, it's good. You know, it's a miscommunication, misrepresentation of what asylum seekers ask for. Most asylum seekers would like to be given basic rights. And I'd like to take this opportunity now on behalf of all asylum seekers, our majority, that asylum seekers do not need help. What they need is the basic human rights. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not fair you're giving someone a work permit and then you're not giving them a driver's permit, and you have them in an isolated part of Ireland. You know, like in Monaghan, where I'm based, it's basically a dumping ground.
Yeah. Cano, I just want to say that two brilliant contributions. I've seen a request from someone in the audience who has in the media looking for a copy of the letter, Anita. If that was possible, we could definitely like to provide that so it could be circulated. That'd be powerful as well. I don't know if anybody else wants to comment other than what can you add to that? Sorry, Vicky, did you want
to? I mean, I suppose it's just like it's a theme across so many things we're going to talk about today. It's about listening to the people involved. Mm. And I'm glad we had the chance to listen, but like the government needs to do that, you know, and we can't maintain a situation where we do things to asylum seekers, you know, as if they are like they should be grateful we're doing anything at all. Like that just shouldn't be our starting point. So the government needs to listen and engage and have those conversations with these amazing people who've been in this atrocious system.
And one of the things about it as well is, and Owen actually pointed it out, you know, in saying what they said about the front door, you know, having their own front door, that is a dog whistle to racists. Yes. And I'm actually going to bring, we have Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chew, with us as well. And Hazel was coming on to talk about a great initiative that she's looking at around inclusivity and diversity and, you know, how we have, you know, various different organisations who are claiming to be running things that are inclusive and diverse and definitely aren't. So, Hazel, how are you? Tony needs to...
I'm good, sorry. It was a bit busy here yesterday in town, as you can imagine. Firstly, Owen, Carnita, thank you for that. And especially thank you for the statement, Carnita. I would love to get a copy if you can send it to me, because I know you're going to be sending it to government, but I'm going to send it to Roderick's team myself. So I think this is one of the things Vicky has touched on. And then what has happened in now, I'm not making any excuses whatsoever. I think you all know my sentiment on, especially in the last few days, of how we need to be very open and transparent about this, and how there's been a dog whistle driven on this very subject, and rhetoric and disinformation being pushed out. So like we all know certain social media platforms are a cesspit, but like in the last 3 days since the announcement, it's become more and more vitriolic. And it's because, to Owen's point, there's divisions being driven by saying, well, people are getting their front door, but then what about everyone else on HAP? These things aren't mutually exclusive. And in every single case, we need to be led by the user. In the case of our homeless crisis, we need to be led by the user, and we need to understand how we accommodate for people who are homeless, how we accommodate for people with families. And we can't write strategy based on what someone else from above thinks. It's the exact same when it's direct provision. I myself am an asylum seeker. So the only thing anyone within our position should be doing is talking to those who are in those positions and asking them what exactly is needed and come to the table. Now, no one's going to ever get everything. That is the unfortunate fact. I would love to say, listen, we can promise the world, but we can't. But one of the things we do have to do is open that dialogue. And maybe, and the white paper to some perhaps will be, and it sounds very much to Owen and Carnita here, that it's disappointing. But one thing that I was quite heartened by what Owen said was coming back to the table and talking about it, because I for me, this is a starting point rather than an end point. This is a beginning of government willing to change a system. Now, perhaps what they propose isn't what should be, but it means that there's a will there that we need to now push. And how do we push it in terms of getting things that people can compromise on and say this works for everyone without putting in more divisions that are there at the moment?
Heza, you were talking to me during the week. We got invited to a lovely thing, which was a diversity and inclusion conference. And when I went and I looked, the tickets were, for the early bird, €135 per person. And I thought, wow, that's really not inclusive, because people in direct provision, people on you know, homeless HAP or single parents or any disability, we're not going to be able to access this. So I emailed the organization who had sent it to me, and I said, hey, yeah, we're lovely, thanks for the invite, delighted to be invited, we'd love to go. We can't really afford it though. And literally the email I got back was, oh, it's not really for you, you know. And I was like, why did you invite us? So I was talking about it on Twitter, and Hazel saw it, and she came up with this brilliant thing of, I'm going to organize a conference and everybody can go. And you were talking about actually that it was more, it was starting off with something that was going to be about unconscious bias, which I think is something that's huge. So tell us a little bit more about what you're planning.
So firstly, I used to work in events. Anyone that is charging $120 to go to a virtual event is just, I have no words. I'm not going to say what, but like the reason why you charge that amount previously to physical events was because of room hire and all that stuff. Like, what is it that you're paying for online that you have to charge someone that? And if it's a event about inclusion, as you said, Linda, it's not very inclusive. It's why when I saw it, I was like, well, this is a bit kind of off. What we're doing on internet, well, it's the day after International Women's Day. I was very conscious that I was really hoping that by January the house would be open back up and I can go out and things would happen and we can have all sorts of events and all sorts of groups here. But that hasn't been the case. So we switched it up that weekly we're going to have things to do with the council and the city and have chats about different subjects with council managers and people in the city. But then there will be also be one big monthly thing and two big monthly three things in March is, one is going to be International Women's Day, but I'm having it the day after because loads of things happen on International Women's Day. And I really don't see why it all needs to happen on that day. It should be kind of all the time. So on the 9th, we're going to have a session, a half day thing on unconscious bias. And we have Mary McAleese and we have other speakers on talking about it. But what we want to do is not just talk about it. We don't want to do just a talking shop. We want to produce a report afterwards and send it up to Roderick and Helen and say, listen, these are certain things you need to look at. And we need to look at now rather than later. And what we were looking to do within the unconscious bias session is talk about, well, inclusion and diversity, because that is really important. When people talk about unconscious bias, they talk about the hiring process, but they don't talk about how it is in everyday life. Like, all of us are some way, shape or form biased without knowing it. So, and that's something we really want to delve into. The other thing is I'll be working with INAR at the end of the month to celebrate Anti-Racism Month. And we're going to have a full day conference looking at the incoming hate speech legislation, because we reckon there could be amendments and we want to make sure those things are in sooner than later. So there'll be a full session on that. And during that, there will be a session, perhaps an afternoon session, on diversity and about what we can do to promote diversity and inclusion again. And then April is about youth and celebrating youth, and then May is post-COVID. But through it all, I've kicked off with Dublin City Council. I've asked them to renew, well, they were due to renew it anyway, but we're going to do a new integration and inclusion strategy for Dublin City, which I have said to the department that it needs to be a template, if possible, for the other local authorities. Like, it comes in as no surprise that, well, by the looks of me, that my parents aren't from here. And I have noticed that 45 years ago, when my parents first got here, they found it really hard to integrate. They found it really hard to be included. And even things that they had to integrate in, like work, like sending their kids to school, they never really felt included in. So part of this strategy for Dublin that I want to put down is that it integrates people, but it also includes everyone from all the communities. So that's what we're doing.
Sounds brilliant. Where can people sign up for Hazel?
So for the International Women's Day one, we'll be putting out a web link in the next week. For the anti-racism, which will include diversity, we will be coming out at the end of more mid-March. For then the overall integration strategy, we're tying into various groups now, but what we really would love to do is start a migrants forum for Dublin so that people can feed in. That has no sign up yet, but we're trying to get that in place.
Brilliant. And I just want to point out the Abolish Direct Provision campaign has a big thing on the 5th of March, which is around ending period poverty. And that's going to be a fantastic, there's a brilliant lineup for that as well. And I believe that they're also having an International Women's Day event, which I will be at. So please.
This is the thing for the various groups. Like, I heard about the period poverty campaign. I love it. And I'm happy to help in any way. If any of the groups here or anyone here wants any support in any way, let me know. And I'm happy to support, and I'm happy to do whatever it needs. So, and I won't be charging either. So just shout. And there's a certain amount in the last day, I've noticed, the more united we can be, even with our differences or wherever we disagree on, the better the outcome, because it's going to be a really rocky time in the next while. So the more that we can kind of stay together, the better. And Zoe just asked, how can we contact you? It's lordmayor@dublincity.ie.
So. Brilliant. Hazel Chu, thank you so much. And thank you to the guys from Abolish Direct Vision as well. I'm going to have to move on because we do still have a lot to get through. So Vicky, I'm going to come to you because we've already kind of touched on it a little bit. Let's have a little chat about what happened in Dublin City yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, there is so much to say about this. I'm like, most people have probably watched the videos already. I mean, like, from my perspective, the things that strike me is, firstly, how did that scale of gathering even happen in the first place? We know the guards had intel about this. They closed Stephen's Green. I've also heard there was a lot of armed response units near Micheál Martin's house in Cork yesterday. And so they knew it was going to be big. And how did that number manage to gather? Like, that could have been policed in different ways. You know, you have a right to protest, but not public health is one of the reasons why that can be limited. So that could have been limited. The violence is obviously, it's so striking, right? It was so overt and brazen, and like watching that firework being shot, it's really hard to watch. I mean, no guard should face that, but like obviously so many members of the public were put in severe danger as well. Like it's really, really dangerous.
One of the protesters got hit twice in the face.
And like things that really bother me is firstly, like it is completely irresponsible in my view for the Minister for Justice to turn around and say that these are mindless thugs. That is just inciting people. We have to engage in a proper way as to why people are joining our, and maybe not all of those were joined for far right movements. You know, they were there for different reasons, but the growth of the far right, like we have to address it and we have to engage with communities and understand why people are feeling so disempowered, so disenfranchised, so excluded that they're joining these groups. And that's really hard work for government to do. And just labeling them mindless thugs is inflammatory. It's excluding them further. It's saying your views have no place in this society, which, you know, ideally, that's what we all want to achieve, but that's not how you get there. And then, of course, there's the fact that the guards and then RTE label this as a mob combining the far left and the far right. And, you know, it is great that the commissioner has come out today and clarify that and rectify that. And it's, for me, it's a first. We've never seen a commissioner who's willing to do that kind of thing before. And he did it, you know, after George and Kencho shooting, he was willing to come out and say, no, there were no, you know, he'd had no previous convictions, but we shouldn't be getting to that point in the first place. And like, there are real reasons why it's so important to name correctly who's engaged in this, because that determines what the issue is we actually have to tackle. And it was just, to turn around yesterday and say everyone was at it, is so dismissive.
Well, you only have to go back a few months to myself and Martin had a podcast that was not very well received, where we interviewed Mick Clifford because he'd written a piece about, you know, and it was one of this, you know, I looked at the protest and I couldn't tell one from the other, and it was a protest and an anti-protest or whatever way you want to go. And you know, we had a pushback about it. And Linda, you referenced the fact that I emceed one of these events back when it was safe to do it during pre-COVID. And I could tell you that, yeah, the tension on the streets is terrifying when you're actually there. Yeah. But what I absolutely welcome the Garda Commissioner clarifying it. I really do. Unfortunately, the lie had travelled around the world. By the time he was correcting it, but nonetheless,
Well, RTE have a job to do now.
Yeah,
RTE have got to do. They have got.
Like it was not acceptable to see Paul Reynolds write a piece this morning commenting on the commissioner's statement without engaging in any reflection on how he put forward one side yesterday and did not do his job as a journalist to question what is coming from Official Ireland. Like, that is his job.
The other thing that I think is really important that you've pointed out is the fact that we do need to talk to communities and different areas and different genres. Like, there is a locked out generation, and Hazel, you get this stuff about around housing and homelessness and how the city is impacted. James, you talk to people all the time who are disempowered and the fact that they feel disenfranchised by this thing and they turn to different things. I mean, we can't just say, oh, they're far right loonies, when really what a lot of this at the heart of this is inequality and the like.
Sorry, James, go ahead.
Sorry, just briefly. You know, we could learn a lot from America, where they were labeled as deplorables, and it's just, you know, that type of rhetoric doesn't help. And I remember hearing Noam Chomsky talking during Donald Trump's initial rise, you know, and he was saying that Donald Trump's supporters was driving down the road with Make America Great Again stickers on their cars, and the windows has been smashed in by Democratic supporters. He said, that's not how you engage. That's how you make them stronger. And, like what Vicky was saying, you have to engage them with dialogue, and you have to, you know, you can't meet or label them deplorables. You know, it's just, we know where it ends.
But there was a classist element to yesterday, because we saw the, you know, the sweatshirts with the wrong spelling on the back, and the amount of people who hopped on that and were like, oh, these are all really uneducated people. They're not. These are people who are disenfranchised, who have been shit on from a height for a number of years, who are feeling like the government isn't doing anything for them, but they're not seeing any alternatives of anybody listening to them. They're not seeing investment into their disadvantaged communities. They're seeing hotels coming up left, right and centre. And Zoe made this point yesterday. Hotels left, right and centre, when there's no playgrounds. There isn't a single GAA pitch in Dublin 1. The nearest one is Dublin 3 or Dublin 8. There's nothing in the inner city. The only thing they have is AstroTurf pitches. There's no football pitches. So if we want to engage these people, we need to give them the facilities.
And ignore this at your peril, because we don't have to look far to see where this goes. You know, the like, people who were disenfranchised, unemployed, socially excluded in England, where do they go? The BNP. Mm. We can look at Northern Ireland. We've seen it on this island, you know.
The National Party are campaigning in South Inner City. There you go.
Okay, and, can I just say something? Like this rhetoric about far left, far right. We know what the far right looks like now. It fires rockets at Gardaí. So that's what the far right looks like. What does the far left look like? And also the idea that this is entirely a class of people. No, that's wrong. They may be the ones firing the rockets on the streets, but the ones lighting the fuses certainly aren't on the streets firing rockets. And that goes all the way into sections of what we call mainstream media.
Yeah.
To think that that anti-lockdown march was fueled just at working class level is nonsense. It was fueled by business. It was fueled by newspapers. So the idea that the far right is pandered to only in working class areas, I completely disagree. It's organized by non-working class areas.
No, and like that's so true. And that's the fear of it, because you have people in position of powers who can abuse that to protect their own interests, right? Because they don't want the lefty changes happening. But they stoke that fear among people, and they tell them, this is because your state has let you down. This is, you know, they don't care about you. The only way is this way. And absolutely, 100%.
Hazel, you wanted to come in there?
Yeah, it's to Vicky's point that you don't have to look far, and you kind of look at UK and you look at Farage, he doesn't come from a working class background.
Yeah.
You look at US and Trump didn't come from a working class background, but they had this following. And it comes to, again, when you say classes, Linda, here, there is a huge class divide. And I don't think people like admitting there is a huge class divide. And it's the same over in the States, that it's no coincidence that the people who are poorest are the Blacks or the Latinos, so are the immigrants. And this is the same over here, that it's building us, that there is this class divide, but people refuse to see it. They the only way they see it is when they shit on us, you say. So whereas what really needs to happen is understand, well, how are we going to fix this? It cannot be postcode lottery when it comes to facilities. It can't be postcode lottery when it comes to housing. So and how do we build that to better? And I'm really sick and tired of the phrase build back better as well. There was no better back even before the pandemic. And there shouldn't be the whole thinking of building back better. It should be, where are we building now? And if it takes the type of crap that we saw outside our door, like we were here yesterday and we saw people being arrested and we heard the fireworks. And I really hate that it takes it to this point. But what I really want to know, and I've been asking my colleagues for the last day, and I'll be asking the Minister of Justice myself next week when I see her to talk about hate speech, is where are we going here? What is the plan? Because it's not like it's something that cropped up overnight. No. This has been building and building, and it just so happens that the pandemic is that perfect storm. But after we finish this pandemic, what will happen again if we don't keep it in check?
Be the next thing.
Yeah, and that's something that we all have to ask and we all have to push for, is what is the plan of yours to tackle this issue?
Yeah, Absolutely. And we have our own job to do in it as well. So, guys, we're going to have to leave it there. We could have talked about this all day, I know, because there's so many different elements to it that need to be covered, but we need to move on. Tony, I'm going to come to you and we're going to talk taxation.
I'm going to be very quick. We started a podcast this week with a series collaborating with the Global Alliance for Tax Justice. I'm really excited to be working with these fantastic people who are doing amazing work, so much so that they've been recognized by being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for the work that they've done in taxation. So that's really phenomenal to see. But one of the things that came out this week, and it just shows you where we are, two companies put nearly 5 billion of profits through Ireland and paid zero taxes on that through a complex arrangement by subsidiaries, sub funds, and basically setting up all manner of little things where they used to, this is if you people remember the whole double Irish and the double Irish with the Dutch sandwich, this is the green jersey on top of the Dutch sandwich on top of the double Irish. And we're in a situation whereby that money may not necessarily, Ireland might not have a claim on that money, but some state does. Some health services is suffering for it. Some education services suffering for it. All, you know, people are struggling to pay rent somewhere else because of this. And we need to own up to this, and we need to be more cognizant of that. The party's over. The EU this week decided that they're going to actually now make companies publish where they make their profits and where they pay their taxes. Must point out, when the vote happened, Leo Varadkar objected on Ireland's behalf and said no, he didn't want it to be made public. They didn't want tax transparency. And we need to be honest about where what this means, because what it means on the flip side is, and this is my real, where we're getting to is, go check out the Dublin Inquirer's piece this week about the homeless accommodation in Dublin City. And Hazel, you're very aware of this, that there are a couple of sites that have been used by people that are organizations. I know of two homeless emergency service accommodations. If you look behind the property company that owns them, they're owned by Goldman Sachs, ultimately, if you follow the money, as I always say to people. They're making huge money, huge profits out of homelessness. And this is a real problem. And I know the guys here are here from Abolish Direct Provision. And again, they know better than I can about, you know, where the widest profit in human misery. And when we have that system on one side where we're basically paying for bed spaces to accommodate people in shitty accommodation, and then on the other hand, we're allowing two corporations, 5 billion tax-free. Imagine. That's in 1 week, guys. It happens. Where we have to be honest about it, and we need a real conversation about it. Rant over.
Can I just say, we need to be really careful that Tony doesn't start now claiming that he's doing Nobel Prize nominated work, because like that's where this is going.
Okay. Right? It is absolutely where it's going.
I've got to say, can you get my name added to the bottom of that?
Nobel Prize winner Tony Grove.
We'll keep you humble, Tony, don't worry about that.
we try constantly.
That's quite a challenge, James.
Martin, I'm going to come to you. So kids are back in school tomorrow.
Yeah, and unlike Tony, I'll actually be brief. Look, go and look at Olive Blogs on Twitter. Olive Blogs has put out a report. There's a lot of data in it. They've done a lot of deep diving on the figures. Read it, make up your own minds on it. What do I think? I think, look, parents just don't have a choice, and that's really it. And I know a lot of parents are concerned, and there's a lot of parents who are going to send their kids back and be on tenterhooks. There's other parents who just can't afford to send them back because they're in precarious situations health-wise. So, you know, it's really difficult. We need the schools to work, but we also need the numbers down, and we don't have the numbers down. I think everybody knows this is an experiment. I think everybody knows this is a test. I hope it works, but I also hope that it doesn't put people in danger. And that's really what I feel about it at the moment. But go look at the figures. The figures are scary about infections in kids. They just are.
Parents United put out a 300-page study.
That's the Olive Blog study. Yeah.
And there was 1,017% increase in cases in children for the 6 months since September. Well, for the 5 months since September, when the kids went back to school, and the rate of cases went from 1,100 in children aged 0 to 18 to 13,400. So those figures are pretty terrifying. And if your kids are going back to school tomorrow, I know it's a double-edged sword. You're probably delighted to be not doing the homeschooling. And to, I literally saw kids Sorry.
Can I be cheeky and just ask, is the mini mayor going into primary care center?
Yes, and it took us a while, Tony. It actually took us a couple of weeks to decide on it, but in the end, we couldn't. There was something that triggered it. It was what was happening outside the house a couple of weeks ago that made us put her in. And then when she was in, we were there going, okay, now we have to make the decision on, now the protest is over, do we keep her in? And I read, Linda, to your point, I've been talking to a lot of parents. It's complete split side at the moment. There are so many parents that see the reports that you're talking about and worried about what the risk is and worried about what will happen. And they mightn't be putting their kids into school. So a lot of them won't. But then there are other parents that I see that are there going, listen, we just can't afford to keep them at home anymore. So like everyone working from retail to frontline to other jobs, well, not the frontline, some of the essential workers have crash facilities and school, other facilities, but the school facilities haven't been there for them. So they're at their end of the tether is going, what do we do? And they will be sending. So there's no right answer to this one. I love
this. Yeah, but that like... Yeah. Pisses me off so much because of how things were handled in December, parents are now being put in that position.
Yeah.
You know, we should be in a place where it's safe to return our kids. If we'd adopted a we can be zero approach from the outset, you know, it would be safe for our kids to go back and our parents wouldn't be stressing and like probably losing sleep at nights worrying about the impact of all of this.
We're going to have to move on. So Vicky, I'm going to come to you about... Yes, we're gonna back a motion to extend the commission to the mother and baby homes, but we're not actually going to do anything about it.
Stop, lads. I mean, the treatment of the survivors this week is just appalling. Oh, your records are destroyed. Oh, wait, no, they're not. Oh, we're going to extend the commission. Oh, wait, we're not. Today is the last day of the commission. It ends at midnight, right? And the position we're in is that we're told that all the records will be with Roderick's department by tomorrow. There is no verification of that. And if it turns out later this week that they're not all there, like what's going to happen then? It means the ending of the commission means the ending of the Data Protection Commissioner's investigation because they can't investigate a body that no longer exists. And it means An Garda Síochána can no longer investigate any potential claims if they were going to do that. It means that the activities and behaviours of the commission can't be judicially reviewed because it no longer exists. And it means that there can be ultimately, now there was probably a slim chance of this, but no correction of the report. And so that the chapter ends at midnight. That's that. The report is what it is. The like records surviving will be what they will be. And then we move to the next fights, which is seeing what the Minister does with the records. Are they all there? All of that. But also the Industrial Burials Bill, which is probably being... slipped under the radar, but it's all about what is the government going to do with at the sites, all the different sites in terms of the bodies that are buried there. And we have government trying to simply absolutely ignore all of their legal and human rights obligations and just disapply and say, no, do you know what? We're not going to have coroners do anything to do with those. We're just not going to have it, which they are legally obliged to do. So it's just one of these sagas where like there's at no point is anyone stepping in and saying, let's just treat these survivors with the respect they deserve and give them what they're entitled to, give them their due. The state has victimized them and perpetrated enough injustices against them. But no, it's going to continue and the fights are going to continue and we're nowhere near the end of this issue.
Yeah.
You can tell I'm angry.
Yeah, and rightly so. And if we're angry, you can imagine how the survivors and the adoptees feel. Like
we interviewed Siobhan this week, myself and Martin, who was not in one but two mother and baby homes and left in 1989. So this is in our lifetimes. This is where it is. And she was very well. She put herself across very well. She handled herself with great dignity, I'm trying to say. But my God, was it difficult then to hear it from our point of view, sit there. And then I naively said, Martin, as you know, that I thought the government might do the right thing, didn't I? It was, bigger fool me. I genuinely thought.
Yeah.
Sorry, there's a question in there from Zoe. Okay, can this go to the European Commission as a human rights abuse or the European courts? I mean, yeah, it can, but it takes about 5 years to get there.
There. I know some groups are actually planning that.
They are, but it takes to get the European court, it takes 5 years.
And you can't undo the damage anyway if you get
And it does more damage to have to keep fighting the case.
The damage is done. The damage is already done. The damage was done the minute they tried to seal the records.
The damage was done the minute they put those women in those homes.
Yes, well, absolutely. Guys, we're going to move on because it is 10:45 and I'm sure we have loads of Q&A to do. So, yeah, so we're going to do
Can I just very quickly bring Andrew, Andy in? Because Andrew O'Brien, Andy, are you there? Okay. Unmute yourself there, horse.
How are you?
How are you, Andrew?
Thanks for having us on.
Not at all. Look at the poster, the background. Of course it is.
Andy,
do you want to tell the guys about the May Day badge promotion for our inner city helping homeless, please? Get the plug in.
Yeah, sure. I'll be very quick. I kind of zoned out for a moment because I was running the numbers. And over the past 6-7 days, like we've raised about 581 euro. So we're nearly at 600 euro just for inner city helping homeless. So this is an initiative that I started last year. Like, it was kind of born of the fact that there was going to be no sort of mass trade union May Day celebration, like where you'd usually have like sort of a demonstration along O'Connell Street in Dublin in celebration of May Day, which in itself, it's a commemoration of the Haymarket massacre in Chicago in the 19th centuries. In the 19th century, where trade unionists, they were hung for campaigning for the 8-hour workday. So, look, like, you know, this is all about sort of this is all about actually sort of remembering the fact that, you know, we are constantly trying to raise living standards. So, you know, I decided I was going to sort of get badges like this with the picture of James Connolly and Jim Larkin. And, you know, I was going to sell them and raise a bit of money for inner city helping homeless. Was it bring a bit of May Day spirit into people's homes, even though they can't all be together. So it's still about 7 weeks away. And actually, coincidentally, the 1st of May is my birthday, so, you know, extra sort of reason to celebrate.
Where can we buy the badges, Andy? Come on.
You can buy, do you know what? You can buy them on maydaybadgeappeal.bigcartel.com. And there's also sort of the Twitter account. Was it at May Badge Appeal? So come and follow us there, and was it get your badges and raise some money and have a bit of May Day spirit, even though we might all be apart for the demonstration this year. Thanks very much for having us on.
You can find Andy at Andy M O'Brien on Twitter. Do buy them. It's a great initiative. It's a great cause, and they're pretty cool as well, actually. So credit where credit's due. Fair play.
There you go. And Advance Abolish Direct Provision have said they'll take 200 from you. So well done.
Excellent.
All right. Right, we're going to move on to our hero of the week. So I will go, Martin, who's your hero of the week?
My hero of the week is the chairperson of the Revenue Commissioners. That's my hero of the week because for the first time in 28 years, they have admitted that they are using test cases to make group and class decisions on employees. And I think he's a hero for admitting to it. There you go.
James, have you a hero of the week?
Yeah, I was thinking about this yesterday, and when I seen the video of the rocket being fired at the guards, I was like, they're my heroes of the week. You know, sometimes it's a thankless job, and, you know, like, they're a guard is like anybody else out trying to make a living, and the thought of him going home to his wife and kids with a destroyed face over a firework, you know, so fair play to the guards for doing a job that most of us wouldn't do.
Vicky?
Noelle Brown, I mean, her work over the last week to try and extend the commission and just her unrelenting determination.
Yeah, she is. She is an absolute hero. And I'm going to go with somebody who's in the audience. So I'm going to go with Zoe Obenheim, who is a massive campaigner for the inner city. She has done a huge amount of work raising issues for around Oliver Bond and all of the flats around the inner city. So and I she's a great person to follow on Twitter. She talks total sense. So she's my hero. Oh, Tony, I didn't know you were.
No, you're okay. Hazel, do you have a hero that you'd like to add for the...
I was going to say Andrew here, but like I completely second Linda's point. Actually, Zoe has been amazing. Zoe does a lot of work down in Oliver Baum's Flats, but across the board as well. And she, yeah, I've met, like, anytime I meet her, it's great crack as well. So yes, I think for me, saying Zoe, but like in fairness, I like Andrew. Totally took Andrew's thunder away, Linda.
Sorry. Sorry, Andy, I owe you a drink. Tony?
No, look, I'll say fair play to Andy. You keep pushing that. You keep pushing. You were sending Christmas cards. That all the proceeds went to inner city helping homelessness as well. All of that stuff, it doesn't go unnoticed, mate. Fair play to you. Yeah.
Oh, well, look, like, you know, it's just small things, and you know, like, look, we've all had a mad year. Like, it's this day, this very day, this year, that Ireland actually had its first confirmed case of COVID. And, you know, I remember it.
I didn't want to bring that up because...
It's our 30th episode. It's the sunny happy.
Actually, can I say, there? Like, I'm going to cut across and say, yes, you brought it up, but can we just say that that is also a good day that the guys are doing a hashtag thanks a million a year on to try and turn it into things that we're grateful for. So let's try and put it on that way. Hey, Hazel.
Hazel has to run. Hello, Mini-Mayor. Hello.
Bye-bye to everyone. Say bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Thanks for coming to say hello.
Surprise. Bye.
Bye. Guys, we're going to leave it there for the non-patron version. You know, if you want to be here next week, it's really easy. Patreon.com/Torchjack. We're going to open the Q&A. So we'll open a couple of mics. We'll get a few people on and we'll continue the chat for the patrons. Have a great week.